lovely to see all of you. I'm glad you could come and engage Professor Bilal Kuspinar. Bilal was born in Konya, in the shadow of Rumi's tomb, and has returned there to teach at the Necmettin Erbakan University. He's the chair of philosophy there. He also has just been appointed the director of the International Rumi Center for the Study of Civilization. So that's something that's being developed at this point. Bilal Abi taught at McGill and Concordia here in Canada. Part of his family still lives in Montreal. He himself tends to travel a great deal, so he was in Saudi Arabia recently, and I was really delighted that he came, you know, with a short stop in Turkey to Quebec from Saudi Arabia, because they are in need of establishing a new religious police department in Quebec. And I think he may be willing to
do it together.
I have to take that off of there. He has published widely, and some of you may have heard Bilal Abi when he spoke here in Edmonton in one of the Running Center events a while back. So we had the pleasure of spending some time together a couple of months ago in Konya, and we also have a bit of a proposal underway to see if we can develop a partnership with the university in Turkey and with the Augustana campus. And there's a real interest in Turkey in two things. One is graduate students becoming comfortable in English, because Turkey sees itself, and I think justly so, as positioned to play a significant role in the development of a new kind of civilization. And also a deep interest in the study of religion and what that means both within the Muslim world and in Turkey, its particular take on all that, as well as what does it mean in the West. And many issues, the issues of the secular pluralism and what have you. So I'm looking forward to the fact that we will likely unfold that in one way or another. So I'm delighted he's here to speak. I've asked him to speak for 20, 30 minutes. So you will have a chance to talk together.
Okay.
Take it away.
Thank you very much, David Abi. We call Abi in Turkish elder brother. Mm-hmm. So that was our custom. And I am very pleased to be with you and to address a topic which is very broad, like an ocean, and deeply or an endless ocean. What I will try to do to give you an overview of Sufism or mystical tradition in Islam, mysticism, and maybe we give some examples, since I'm coming from the town of Rumi, who is a world-renowned mystic and had influence and has been influencing, I guess, many thinkers and intellectuals and also common folk around the world. It is about 10th century, 950s, there was a scholar who wrote extensively on what Sufism is. And he was asked the question, what Sufism is? And he said, Sufism is a name without reality. Mm-hmm. But it used to be a reality without name in the past. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, you know, 10th century. I guess today, more or less the same thing. It applies, and it is rather a name, maybe without reality. But there are some people who try to revive the reality of Sufism, restore to its original sources. As is in the case of many other religious traditions, Islam too has inner dimension. It is what we call spirituality of Islam. So spiritual quest for a permanent meaning in life, it is regarded as Sufism. And it is not a sect. some people today consider Sufism, you know, apart from Islam. No. It is basically integral part of Islam. It is a spiritual extension of Islam. It is the highest, maybe, level of awareness of God and piety, you know, in a sense. In the 19th century or towards the end of 18th century, of course, because of these Oriental studies in the world, there was a tendency among Oriental scholars to show Sufism as something different from Islam. They tried to situate Sufism in other traditions, such as Zoroastrianism or Hinduism or Buddhism or Neoplatonism and other religious traditions. There is an element of truth in this. But as far as inner dimension of Islam is concerned, as a reality, it has emerged within Islam, within the source of Islam, but later developed in interactions with eventually other traditions. So it has been heavily influenced right around the beginning of the 8th century, where was the translation movement in Islamic civilization began. Meaning, when I say translation movement, the works of Aristotle and Plato and the Greek thinkers began to be translated first in the Syriac language, then into Arabic language. This was a time also Sufism began to be influenced and somehow reached the level of philosophizing or theorizing. One can say that Sufism has been influenced by, for example, Neoplatonism at that time. But it is an integral part of Islamic faith and piety. So the term Sufi, and as I will explain shortly, comes from, in fact, Arabic. And when we look at the origin of this term, Sufi, it has three meanings. And each one plays an important role in the development of this tradition later. One, which is commonly accepted by Muslim scholars and also Western scholars, that Sufi is the person who, in the past, used to emulate Prophet Jesus and his disciples in terms of his piety and consciousness of God, but also in appearance. And they used to wear a special garment or woolen cloth, which was white, and they used to be called Sufi, the one who is wearing Sufi, like a cloth made of wool, and which was, of course, typical attire of Jesus, peace be upon him, and also disciples of Jesus. So in emulation of him and his disciples, some of the Muslim pious practitioners used to wear this, and there the name Sufi came. And when we look at the history of Islam around 800 or 780, the term began to be circulated among Muslim world. Now, the second meaning of Sufi is the one that who purifies, cleans his mind and his heart and his carnal soul, or try to, you know, clean his bestial desires and devote himself or herself or himself exclusively to the service of God, and hoping in the end to be united with God, to reach the level of self-realization. The self-realization, which is called, you know, annihilation of human self and persistence and subsistence in God or with the name of God. So the second meaning is that cleansing the heart or the human mind from all kinds of blemished desires, all kinds of evil thought or bad thought. So this is the second meaning. In fact, there is a strong practice in Sufi tradition which concentrates on self-introspection, you know, self-examination, and cleaning the mind and thinking good of everything and around everybody. So the third meaning is at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, when he constructed his own mosque, which is called the Mosque of Medina or Prophet's Mosque, he reserved a certain space of the mosque for the people who had no home, like homeless. So they were given kind of shelter. At the same time, they were given special training by the Prophet. And this place was called Suffa. And the people who stayed there are called the people of the bench, because the place was a little higher in the mosque. And because of this name, Suffa is originated from the Sufi. So there, you know, the name came Sufism. But the third version is the least accepted among the scholars. So as far as the origin of Sufi is concerned, it comes from, again, mainly, as agreed by many intellectuals and writers, coming from the early Muslims who tried to emulate Prophet Jesus and his disciples by their, you know, sincerity and devotion to God, as they were wearing also this woolen garment, and as part of their distinct, you know, characteristics. Why a Sufism was today or is today very popular? For at least two reasons. One, it is regarded by many as the open window of Islam to the rest. In a sense, it is like the breath of Islam, the spirit of Islam, because of its tolerant attitude, or because of this emphasis on plurality, diversity, and because of it, it is, you know, emphasis on the essence of the teachings of the religion rather than, you know, the formalities and the appearance. So because of this, it was well received, you know, it is like welcomed by many people outside even the Muslim world. The second reason is that I can give an example from Rumi himself, Jalaleddin Rumi, who lived, you know, in Anatolia, in our city. As I mentioned earlier, he was asked, "What is prayer?" And he gave the example, of course, and then says that, like, rituals, daily rituals that one practice as part of the requirement of the law. And he says, "What is greater than prayer?" And he answered, "The soul of the prayer is greater than the prayer, the essence of the prayer." And he said, "Why?" Because, you see, there are times that one can stop praying because of the health reasons, because of some valid reasons. So you can, you know, postpone your prayer. But the soul, you cannot neglect. And it, in a sense, it is faith itself. So faith is continuous, like the soul, so long as, you know, human being alive. But the prayer can be stopped because of the circumstance. And so he basically touched upon the heart of the inner dimension of the religion. He says, essence of Islam is the soul of Islam, which is, in fact, the faith itself. So, and then... here he gives, you know, more elaborate explanation on the meaning. The sources of Sufism, according to Muslims, are two. One, the Quran, and the second is the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. And when we look at today, the Quran, for example, there are two among many concepts or even rituals which are taken very seriously by the Sufis. One is celebrating the name of God, remembering the name of God, which is called dhikr, either secretly or loudly, you know, chanting the name of God, and which means keeping awareness of God always and feeling the presence of God in your heart. So it is in the Quran, and in many places it is repeated. So Sufism put a lot of emphasis on this essential teaching of the Quran, which is taken, for example, as one of the rituals of the Sufism. And this kind of celebration or chanting name of God can be practiced some of the Sufis indifferently. For example, in Mevlevi, founded by the disciple or son of Mevlana Celaleddin Rumi. It's called Mevlevi Sufi Path. This zikr, remembrance of God, is practiced in the company of musics. And it's, therefore you see the whirling dervishes. They spin around their axis while remembering God and chanting of God, and of course doing some kind of very self-concentrated, you know, movement. And as you see, this dhikr, which is for some people just the prayer itself, some people just the calling the name of God or calling the names of God, which is according to the Quran more than 99 or more. And for some people, it is in the company of musics. And for Sufis, even when they look at these beautiful trees, like wind whispering, they say this is in fact, everything is remembering God. Everything is celebrating the name of God. So Sufi life already in the heart of the cosmos, in the heart of the universe, in the heart of all the living beings, not only not necessarily in human being. And this is of course a very general view. Another reason why Sufism has been paid attention by people outside Islam is that because of its ecumenical interfaith aspect. And like Rumi and Ibn Arabi, some Sufis are interpreted differently. And they wrote, and of course they have lyrics and in prose, a great deal of teachings. When we look at, you can interpret their teachings according to your own philosophy. They are like susceptible of many meanings. They are amenable to various interpretations. So one can find a pluralistic approach of Islamic faith over there. Therefore, they are taken as an example for pluralism within Islam. And because of that, so Sufis are maybe more open to dialogue, if you call this, or interfaith cooperation and collaboration, than maybe other formal Muslims or religious practitioners. Okay. As far as the development of Sufism is concerned, I can identify four stages, just to be very brief in history. The first stage is the time from the time of the Quran's revelation, which can be marked like the beginning of 7th century, exactly 610, where Muhammad received the first revelation, and until 700s. Okay, end of the first caliphate period. So this is what we call the resourceful stage, where essential principles of Sufism were laid down by the Quran, by the teaching of Muhammad, and also his early followers, or the Muslims. This is called the early stage. The second stage is ascetic stage. Ascetic stage, some Muslims really distance themselves from the lavishness of life, from the luxuries of life, and try to be a kind of dervish, a person who is completely dependent on God, and he is indigent in a sense. He doesn't need anything else. So they were kind of fed up with the luxury of this some people around. So they try to lead a life of seclusion. They retreat themselves from the public and, you know, be ascetic. So the second stage of the Sufism is ascetic stage, which spans from 700 until 850s. And 850s, of course, the time of the translation, as I mentioned earlier. And the third stage is the formative stage. There began in Muslim world a debate whether Sufism is permissible in Islam or not. Whether it's acceptable because of it is, you know, openness to other religious traditions because of some ideas, some jurists, okay, strict-minded people, consider some of the practices as innovations in Islam. You know, he said, this is not part of Islamic religion. So it is this time where genuine Sufi themselves began writing manuals, you know, books on their own teachings. So it is the stage where books being produced, literature being produced on the essential aspects and practice of the Sufism. The fourth stage, which is in fact the most flourished stage of Sufism, is the time where theosophical studies, philosophical doctrines of Sufism came into being. An example, of course, again, Rumi in Anatolia, and Ghazali, for example, in the East, and Ibn Arabi in Muslim Spain in the West. So there were great figures who really philosophized the Sufi traditions and gave a cosmic outlook, or they developed cosmological and ontological theories, you know, based on their own teachings. And of course, the later period is basically a commentary period. And later Muslims wrote commentaries on the early teachings of the Sufis. When we look at the Quran itself, the second example I would like to give, the ascension of the Prophet Muhammad to heaven, which is of course similar to Jesus, it is called Miraj in Arabic. So whether this journey that Prophet Muhammad undertook in the year 620 or approximately between 619 and 20, whether it was a physical journey or a spiritual journey. There was still a debate among Muslims. But the commonly accepted view that Muhammad was taken physically and spiritually by God, you know, in the company of an angel from Mecca to Jerusalem. From Jerusalem, he was taken up to the heaven. So now, it says, this miraculous journey, in fact, is the peak of Sufi practice. Although Muhammad took this journey physically, but the Sufi today undertake this journey spiritually within himself. So that was a journey in the world, and Sufis take a journey in their own heart. So the best, the shortest way for a Sufi to reach God is to cleanse the heart and make the heart as a place where God has glance. God can see himself in this polished mirror of the believer. So it says this journey of Muhammad is taken as an example for the Sufis that anyone, you know, who is sincere in his faith or her faith can practice and reach this highest level of self-realization. And there are also other examples from the Quran. The second stage for ascetic Sufis, I can give the example of Bayazid al-Bistami. And a very interesting figure. He, for example, in the Quran says, "Glory be to God." And how majesty, how powerful God is. This Abu Yazid Bistami, who lived in the 9th century, because of his overwhelming love of God, he became intoxicated, what we call, with the divine love. Okay, and so he entered into a rapture state where he exclaimed, and he said, "Glory be to me." Look at now changing. "Glory be to me. How great I am." And everybody said, "This is blasphemy." So this is an example at the ascetic stage, you know, where the rapture stage. And so, but later Muslims, he said, no. In fact, he is testifying the real unity of God. He is removing all the duality. It is no longer he who speaks. It is God who speaks through him. So this is the second stage of, like, you know, love is dominating, overtaking this sincere, you know, observer or the believer. And this is the second stage of, is an example. And once someone came and knocked at his door, this Bayazid Bistami, he said, I am looking for Bayazid. And he said, look, Bayazid has been searching for himself for 40 years. He couldn't find. Go away somewhere else. So it is with Bayazid there began in Sufi tradition this concept of annihilation, passing away from the human attributes and existing wholly and solely in God. So it's a kind of, union with God. And another example is Hallaj, and he who was executed, and who had also master. Once he came to knock at his door, he said, "Who are you?" And he was Junaid, his teacher, and knock at his door, and he said, "An El Haq in Arabic, I am God." And Haq meaning truth, but capital, because one of the names of God. And Junaid said, He was really perplexed and perturbed by this. He said, "Go away, and there is no place for you in my home." So basically, he drove him away from his home. But he said he somehow had given him a warning. He said, "Look, be careful. By saying this kind of statements, you will cause irreparable, in a sense, danger to your life." Of course. He went to India and searched around. He spent time in Baghdad. When he came back, he was roaming in the streets of Baghdad saying, "An al-Haq, I am God." And the same ascetic stage, like rapture stage, it is an example for the ecstatic Sufis. And some people, of course, some jurists, who acted by the letter of the law, and took this as an offense to Islam, as a violation of the teachings of Islam, and they executed him. When they put him, you know, on the execution, you know, place, he said, "Please, you do your work. You are obliged to fulfill your duty as commanded by God, because you are the guardian of the law. And there is life in my death, there is death in my life." Exactly, this is expression that Hallaj said. So this is the second example. And then later scholars, they said, was really executed for valid, unvalid reasons? Some say yes, some say no. Those who excuse him from this kind of blasphemous exclamations, they said, look, it was not Hallaj himself who was speaking this. It was God who was speaking through him. Because of his love. And so for some of the people, he was the real testifier of the unity of God, monotheist in a sense. For some other people, no, he really offended the Islamic teaching, violated, and therefore he was rightly judged, tried, and executed. So this is another example. Now, so the notion that came into Sufi tradition for the first time, this interested love of God. Like, you love God without any expectation and return. And who taught this concept? A lady, a woman, female, by the name Rabia al-Adawiyya, who lived in Baghdad, about 800. So she exclaimed, she said, "O God, if I worship you in the hope of your paradise, deprive me of your paradise. If I fear of your hell, put me in your hell. But I worship you only for your own sake. And therefore, please do not deprive of your beauty or of your face or your countenance, you know, and from me." So this was an example of this female Sufi Rabia, and this interest love. So the Sufis, they pray, but not like a kind of bargaining. Okay, I'm going to pray, but then in return of which I will get to paradise, or I will get to, you know, pleasures in it. No, they pray as if they see God. Although they do not see God, God sees them. And so they pray because of their love of God. And this is like the whole notion of, it's called in Arabic, Muhabbatullah, selfless love of God. Okay, David Abi, you can, because this is, as I said, huge subject, you can interrupt me anytime. If there are questions, I can answer as well.
I think that people might want to respond.
Okay. Okay, maybe I can give some examples from Rumi in this case. Or maybe the
How about
last
two.
Two. Okay. Rumi is the one whose influence has been throughout Ottoman land. Okay, he lived in the time of Seljuk Arab. He died 1274. As a matter of 1207 was the year of his birth. UNESCO celebrated in the year 2007 the 800 years of his birth. He wrote both in prose and in verse, but most famous work of Rumi is his Masnavi, which couplets, six volumes, which consist of approximately 26,000 couplets. It is regarded by many of his followers, also Muslims, as the versified translation of the Quran in Persian language. But it is interpretation of the Quran. Of course, it is very unorthodox. It is unconventional. He doesn't follow any standards and rules. But his poetic ability is really incredible. Is very immense. He carries a lot of emotions, at the same time meanings in his poetry. Maybe two important points in his life both played like a watershed in a turning point in his development. One, when his father sent him to Damascus to learn Arabic and to study really Islam and basic science of Islam, and also when his father passed away, the disciple of his father took over giving spiritual training to Rumi. The second turning point was he met when he was about 38 years old a person, a wandering dervish, an untidy, unruly man who came in apparition, who came from nowhere, who was then 60 years old. His name was Shamseddin Tabrizi, meaning the son of the deen, or son of faith, from Tabriz. So he came in Konya. In fact, today we know where exactly they encountered. But there was an encounter before in Damascus, very short door. And he asked the question, who is greater, Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, or Bayazid Bistami? Remember Bayazid Bistami, who I said how great I am? So he asked the question, and Rumi was astounded by this question. He said, of course Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, is greater than Bayazid. If this is the case, he said, this Shams, why then Muhammad said, I keep on asking forgiveness of God and praying to God and trying to, seek his infinite mercy. But at the same time, look at this Bayazid. He said, glory be to me, how great I am. And why Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, did not make such a statement? And this shows, And of course, Rumi, that time, said, look, everyone receives the blessing of God according to his ability, according to his capacity. Muhammad has an infinite capacity. Therefore, he couldn't quench his thirst for God. Therefore, he keeps on asking. But Bayazid is a normal man. He has a limited capacity. Therefore, when that capacity was filled with love of God, he outburst. He couldn't hold it anymore. In this sense, you know, so Shams was amazed at his answer. And from then on, this Rumi used to preach, you know, every Fridays and Thursday in the mosque, in his center. But he retreated himself from the public and began to lead a life of privacy with this Shams. And people, of course, got envied. They said, Rumi was used to enlighten us now. He began spending time with this, untidy man, with this unruly, dervish. And we better get rid of this dervish. So this is exactly, and anyhow, this is a long story, but in the end, of course, he disappeared. And Rumi left a huge legacy behind. So he composed this poetry, and also he wrote Diwan-e-Kibir in memory of this friend, this enigmatic figure, Shams. It's a huge, like about 6-volume work. Rumi was criticized. He said, for example, I am with 72 nations. I am good with everybody and anybody. I don't hold anything to anybody. And there were some scholars who said, look, Islam is Islam. How can you be a friend with others? How can you be together with the 72 nations? So, in order to provoke him, they sent somebody and to question in the public. And Rumi said, you claim to be a scholar, and you're saying that you are with 72 nations. But Islam is different. If you are a Muslim, how can be with the 72 nations? Others, like Christians, Jews, you know, and atheists, etc. And is it true that you said this? Rumi said, yes. And I am still saying, I am with 72 nations. Then this fellow, of course, began shouting at him and rebuking him and saying all kinds of words which of course were taken by Rumi in silence. And he said, did you finish? Yes. I am with you too. He said, the essence of human being is pure and clean. What changes human being is the action. So when you look at somebody, look at the heart and the essentiality and what they call primordial nature of human being. When you look at from that angle, you will see all are is equal. But when you look at them by their actions, which are temporary, which are fleeting like a wind, you will make a wrong judgment about people. And and he said, this is the practice of all the prophets, especially Prophet Muhammad. And that's what he said. If I show this, I am literally embodying the teachings of all the prophets and of Prophet Muhammad as well in my life. And so he said, no one can question about his sincerity to Islam. So long as I am alive, he said, I am the faithful follower of the Quran. So long as I am alive, I will be a dust under the feet of the Prophet Muhammad. You see, he shows also his loyalty to it. But at the same time, he has this highest regard. And I don't want to call this tolerance. It's a misleading term. And it regards and respect. Because tolerance is I'm not really comfortable with this term. And respect for all humanity at large.
Regard.
Yeah, exactly. I guess regard is the best. Yeah.
Wonderful.
You see, I don't want to monopolize this session. This is a Sufis, you know, normally do not talk. Although I'm not a Sufi, I'm a theoretician of the Sufis.
May I invite them to?
Please.
So what do you hear? What don't you hear? What piques your interest? What would you like to explore?
When I was in Vienna, I had an exchange student from Vienna, and her father was, he claimed to be a Christian Sufi.
And interesting.
Yeah, very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense to me.
Being in Vienna, however, is a Christian Sufi.
But I think all our teachings of most of our religions say that we are all one. I mean, in a sense, is it Basi? That I am God.
We
are all God.
Maybe I can clarify the use of the term Sufi as different from mystic. Because Sufi is the term used specifically in the context of Islam, because it has its own connotation, it has own implication. But the mystic, it can be given generally for all kinds of, you know, spiritually oriented followers, you know, I mean people, whether it be Christian, Jewish, or Muslim, it doesn't matter. But Sufi is a term that has been used specifically in the context of Islam. And therefore, Christian Sufi, it's rather awkward. the use, maybe Christian mystic, but Islamically oriented, something like that.
The problem is
this. Is the Sufi in favor of the unity of all religions? Maybe there are some Sufis. But as far as this accepted form of Sufism in Islam, no. Everyone has a different characteristic. So that makes, you know, really humanity diverse vis-a-vis the unity of God. So, appreciation of the diversity and plurality on the one hand, but ultimately, of course, as all the Sufis agree, in terms of origin, we are the children of Adam and Eve, therefore we are brothers and sisters, ultimately. But the way we perform, the way we conduct, not necessarily, you know, even among the religions, I mean, but intra-faith, intra-religions, there are differences, like schools of thought. So differences are very important and enriching. And so if someone tries to, you know, be a Christian, a Sufi, I guess it's forcing. It's a kind of forcible to me. This is my opinion. And it doesn't really fit in the overall context of Sufi teachings.
Can you say just a little more about why that regard for difference, for particularity, is so important? Important, it seems to me, also as a kind of spiritual discipline.
Exactly.
That it's a way of disciplining your own mind and your own heart about others. What do you make of that?
If I ask this question to Rumi,
yeah,
he will answer as follows. In relation to God, whether belief or disbelief are the same and one thing. It's wisdom. Unquestionable. It is unity. In relation to God, but in relation to human being, is different. Evil is evil, good is good. One thing. Second, most of the Sufis refer to this specific verse of the Quran, which is from the chapter 49. I guess the verse number 12 or 13. I don't recall exactly. where, you know, God addresses human beings. He says, all people, we created you from, you know, male and female. Later, we divided you into groups. And he said even Arabic shub and qabail, like tribes and nations.
And nations.
Okay. So that you can develop acquaintance with each other, the kind of social acquaintance. Okay. And the best among you is not the who you will judge, is the one who is the most righteous or the most conscious or the most mindful of God. This is the Quranic verse. Mm-hmm. So in this sense, and plurality, like diversity of the religions is there, diversity of the faith is there. And this is the nature of, the raison d'etre of the creation of human being. So as far as human beings are concerned, that there will be differences of religious traditions. But now the question is religion same as the faith? Now this is a big question. I guess faith is one. If faith is in God, I guess one. But and then the role of the prophets is to show that faith in God. If their role, their mission is the same, to lead humanity, their respective communities, to that level, accepting God as their creator, almighty, then differences among the prophets in terms of how they teach this, how they, convey the message that they receive from God. So because of the time, because of the circumstances, because of the space, and because of the needs of the people, this faith may have various manifestations, various expressions, various forms of practices. But ultimately, I guess faith in God is one. In this sense, there is a unity. But there is a unity in faith, but not unity of all religions. I guess this is very problematic to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
If it, just a footnote to
yes,
that,
yes,
quickly. Faith,
yes.
Aquinas sees faith as a disposition of the mind.
Hmm.
A disposition of the mind towards a kind of openness towards the unfolding of the love of God in the world.
Mm. That's faith.
It's not belief.
Yes, I differentiate. Yes, exactly.
So,
yes, you're right.
Yeah.
And
what do you make of this, Harry?
It makes a lot of sense to me. I maybe use different words, but what I see is the realm of God is there's no difference. We live as human beings in this dualistic world.
Exactly.
You know, and but it all comes together as one. And I'm now using another metaphor that I really like, which I took out of The Journey of the Universe. At the beginning of the singularity, there was no separation of anything in the universe. The universe did its thing, expanded, and here we are, 13.7 billion years later, and there's still unity. There is no separation. But how do you put your mind around that? This mind around that there is no separation of anything in the universe. We were there as part of God, maybe, at the beginning of time. And we will be there at the end of time.
Yeah.
So maybe this human journey is a journey of some sort.
This is very interesting, excellent point. I can maybe relate this to this famous verse of the Quran, which is heavily used by the Sufis as a reference for the creation, for the unity of the souls. He says, in the realm of pre-existence, God, before creating the world and the human being, asked the question, the spirits, in a sense. He says, am I not your Lord? All responded affirmatively. Yes, indeed, you are our Lord. That time. He says, no. So for Rumi, he says, for example, we have come from that recognition of God. Well, and somehow we seem to have forgotten this. So all our task is here to remind people of their origin, what they have said to God, how they accepted, and therefore try to kindle this love of longing for God. And so this is the task of Sufis. And this, so it is a kind of passionate longing going back. Therefore, we have all come from Him, ultimately will return to Him. This is, you know, again. Now, that in terms of faith, I guess this is faith over there. Faith. But when we come here, in the back of our mind, somewhere this is there. So each religious tradition is somehow polishing up and reminding their followers. So don't forget this origin. Faith in God is the key. Now, how the faith is defined in Islam, like even Nursid, it's a connection with God without any mediation. So it's
without
a direct,
mediation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is how faith is defined. It's a connection. So it is a self...
By connection, could you say presence?
Exactly. I mean, you can... In Sufism, presence.
Presence in Sufism.
In Sufism, is presence.
Central Ivy.
Yeah, exactly. In Sufism, is presence of God. And you feel the presence. But for a common, you know, folk believer, it's a connection of God.
Is there...
But let me read this from this Ibn Arabi, famous, you know, monotheist, in a sense, Sufi, who lived a contemporary of Rumi, although he's 10 years senior to him. He says, "My heart has become capable of every form, look at this, a pasture for gazelles, a cloister for monks, a temple for idols, the water is Kaaba, the tablets of the Torah, the scroll of the Quran. It is the religion of love that I hold. Wherever turns, it is mounts. Love shall be my religion and my faith." Very similar to what Rumi teaches. So in terms of faith, you know, it is manifested in all these religious holy places. In terms of faith. So he says, "I am with you there. But at the same time, I am with my own system and on the tradition."
Exactly.
I guess this is a beautiful example of it.
Are there other avenues that you might want to bring forward to explore?
This may sound like it's coming out of left field, but there are many of us in this group who have done extensive study of the Enneagram, which in the form that we are looking at it was introduced into the West by Gurdjieff, who... And there are some people who attribute its roots to Sufism. And I'd be interested in your opinion of the relationship between Sufism and Gurdjieff, if you're familiar with the work that he's done on the Enneagram. Does that make any sense to you?
I am not very familiar with with that one, and but I can explore and really because I learn a lot. I mean, I can inquire into that, but I am not very familiar. And if David Abi or you kindly provide me with some materials, after all, we are always engaged, you know, in learning more.
And we have two good teachers here.
Okay, please do so then. And I can give my email and you can forward to me some of the literatures, and I will be very happy to explore. What do you think that from my presentation, do you make any connection with, do you see any,
I would say,
any convergence?
No.
But we had heard that it came out of Sufism, the Enneagram. Would that be right?
It was said that many of the teachings came from a source body of knowledge that had been drawn on from all the religious teachings.
I guess it was the Gnostic tradition which was common to all, probably from that.
Exactly. And that Gurdjieff came across a number of these teachings in some of his his exploration finding some Sufi monasteries, you know, and so that where there was much more preservation of some of his teaching and knowledge.
Can you give me one, for example, concrete example that this is this come from Sufism?
Only the story.
Yeah.
The movements, maybe.
The zikrs and dervishes that are in movements.
Yeah, there was a body of kind of stylistic movements that were like meditative practices that said that they drew from a language of symbol and gesture that apparently Gurdjieff learned in one of these monasteries, mm-hmm. or several of them.
Now, it is true, for example, in the case of Hallaj, whom I mentioned earlier, was executed, and when he was expelled from his teacher's circle, he went away as far afield as like India, where he met, you know, with the Buddhists and Hindus, and he learned a lot. And so they have found more of his teachings later on, like very esoteric. Mm-hmm. And very similar and kind of reminiscent of you know, some kind of, even like a Nirvana, for example, you know, Nirvana, like annihilation, like mm-hmm. this concept of annihilation, like passing away in God by intense meditation, self-reflection, that leads to nothingness, you know, like nihility in a sense, where the Hallaj emphasized this, and they say, okay, maybe he might have borrowed some of the notions from, you know, the teachings of the Buddhist, you know, Buddhism and others, could be, and also some Zoroastrian maybe elements as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you comment on the work of Henry Corbin?
Oh yes, I was privileged to study one of his students because I did my PhD at McGill. His student was Landolt, Herman Landolt. He was of Swiss origins, Switzerland. And he studied with, of course, Hanno Corbin. Hanno Corbin is an imaginary figure. he uses his imagination extensively.
Yes.
And he did a lot of pioneering works in Islamic philosophy, and in particular in Persian Sufism. Like Sohrawardi, for example, philosophy illumination. And also, I worked part of my you know area specializations in fact illuminated philosophy. So he contributed extensively to the field of Islamic philosophy in the context of Persian world, and he wrote on Ibn Sina, Avicenna, and Sohrawardi. I admire him, and he's like an ocean. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what he says when I was reading this Ibn Arabi? He says, of course, and I learned many of all the things from him through also his students, my supervisor. He says, now we have come to the shore of an ocean. Mm-hmm. And we don't know where to go, which direction to go. And I guess it applies to him too. He has so, you know, vast and really so diverse. Studies and research. And he's the like pillar of our philosophical, you know, tradition, as especially in Islamic philosophy.
So, for those of us that aren't familiar with his work, could you create a summary kind of
He mainly is historian. He's a historian. He brought out many hitherto unknown works from the manuscripts. That's his ability. Like philosophy illumination, like great Albertus, you know, and in the 12th century, the Sohrawardi, like all his Persian works came into light, in a sense. He brought light from the manuscripts. He wrote three volumes, of course, all in French, like Introduction à l'histoire de philosophie islamique, and also one volume, History of Islamic Philosophy, like the, even the term something, angelology, Islamic angelology, like, you know, angelology, like angelic world. Is this kind of, you know, technical terms he used. And that's why he is a man of imagination. He is, of course, criticized, apparently, as one of the Orientalists.
Aren't they all?
Yeah, they are all. But I guess he's the, to me, he's the one of the most accurate and consistent historians of Islamic philosophy.
He was, his book started to be published in English in the 60s and brought out by Bollingen, which was established by one of the wealthy American women because she was in love with C.G. Jung.
Yeah,
and he used to go to Ascona,
yeah.
I believe, and was part of that circle as well.
Yes, exactly.
With C.G. Jung and Uncle Joe Campbell. He wasn't there actually.
And he has many students, of course. And one of his students,
remarkable scholar,
Said Nasser. He's a scholar, and
did Nasser study with him?
Yes.
Oh, is that right?
You know, the what was kind of remarkable with these people, and including like William Chittick, who wrote on Sufism in U.S., whom I know very well, and Said Hussein Nasser, Henry Corbin, and Landolt, they had a team. They were given free. open check, in a sense, by the Shah
of Iran.
They spent about 10 years in Tehran, University of Tehran. They established a branch Tehran, University of Tehran branch in Paris. And also, that time they made an affiliation with McGill.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a branch of McGill in Tehran. And
well, I'm just interested to know, it sounds like his work, if it was being more widely becoming known in the 60s, I'm just interested to know what the West or folks that hadn't been familiar with Islam prior, perhaps, what he brought forward. Because obviously the connection with Jung, and I don't know his work at all, but I'm just interested in what it was that he brought forward that in a certain way people could latch onto, or that somehow spoke to them,
Very interesting question, very good question, but one criticism I can make, you know, against him is that he concentrated mainly on Persian Islam.
So that was a narrowing, as you would see it.
That's why he was not, referred, as an authority by like non-Persian, speaking world as far as Islam is concerned. Like he's leaving out Turkey, Ottoman. And Malaysia, in India, this part, Urdu, But I guess under the circumstances, he did his best, That was, available then. What he did, to me, is original, is the following. He showed to the rest of the world, not necessarily Muslim world, the treasure of Islamic civilization from the Persian perspective. The treasure of Islamic civilization. So he broadened thereby he broadened also the vision of Europe as far as Islam is concerned. Especially French speaking world, They had a very limited understanding of Islamic world, Islamic civilization, but thanks to the efforts and writings of Corbin and his students, international world, in particular Persian, French world, came to the realization of what Islam could offer.
And that Islam,
wrong. Yeah.
And that Islam wasn't simply the Salafi.
Exactly, movement, exactly.
But had this mystical tradition.
Exactly.
Central to it.
And exactly, this is
so he's one of the early people to bring
and
that
one
forward.
Of what bothers me most today is this fact. And you know, this religion of great tradition and like I mean produced remarkable literature in arts, liberal arts, humanities, social sciences, medicine, okay, and all and physical sciences were somehow overlooked by a certain group of people, and to show this later addition of political dimension of Islam. They portrayed Islam kind of political, you know, phenomena. And thanks to the people like Corbyn, he said, look, Islam is not, you know, I mean, yes, there is a political section of it, but it is very little. Mm. Here is the rational aspect of Islam and the philosophical, mystical aspect of Islam. That's exactly what he did, and then he achieved this.
So, Pat, there's a book out now. Carolina's having this read already, but I'm a teacher, by Tom Cheatham on Henry Corbin, essentially. But it's called All the World an Icon. And so there's the use of language, the realm of the imagination, metaphor and symbol.
Yeah, exactly.
And how important that is. And then the arts for the expression of reality and the divine.
And so, exactly.
Yeah.
And the another important aspect of Corbyn's style is that he tried to show the continuity of human thought. Yeah. You know, he did not begin the study of Islamic philosophy with Prophet Muhammad. So, you know, as far as Persian is concerned, all the Zoroastrian tradition he brought into picture. So, you know, when you look at, for example, Sohra,
there's a great tradition.
Exactly. And they try to show the Greek aspect, Greek roots, Egyptian roots, and also Zoroastrian, you know, all traditions. And how these notions, allegories, or the concepts played a crucial role in the development of Islamic thought later. So this was the really achievement of Corbyn when we look at his writings.
Has he been taken up among Muslims, Muslim scholars?
Most of his books are translated into vernacular languages, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
In Turkey, all the books, all of his books are translated into Turkish, yes.
In what language did Rumi
Persian.
Persian.
He spoke, of course, Turkish, because apparently in Turkey, and he has also Arabic poetry. I mean, three languages, but mainly in Persian, because that time Persian language was the language of lit poetry and the literature in the Seljuk time. The you know spoken language was Turkish. The language of science was Arabic, but the language of poetry and art was Persian. So he wrote in Persian.
Did he grow up with that in Afghanistan?
Yes, he was born in Afghanistan, in the city of Bel, in 1207, but when he was about 18 years old, he moved from there with his father all the way to Baghdad, from Baghdad to, you know, he made a pilgrimage and then stopped over in Damascus, Aleppo, and came to Konya later on. Thank you very much for your patience.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Good to see you.